I'm here at Real Boxing with trainer Luis Monda. We've known it sort of since 2016.
Yes.
16 from Johnny Tokos. Today we're going to talk about his background and his career as a trainer. So can we first start with where did you grow up?
I grew up in a, it's an offshoot city of Miami. It's called Homestead. That's where I was born. I was born on Homestead Air Force Base in South Florida. And so I grew up between Homestead and then my father lived in Miami. So back and forth between those two places.
Yeah. And how did you get into martial arts?
I had a grandfather who was Irish and very street smart, streetwise, very tough man. He was a Navy corpsman, so he was a medic in the Navy. They're attached to Marines. Mm. So he was very encouraging of me to learn how to fight and how to be tough. So he really kind of gave me like first lessons, you know, like throw little punches at my head and, you know, make me move my head. And then when I was young, I would hit everything.
Like, yeah.
We used to have a tree in front of the house and I used to spend hours hitting the tree, like kicking and, you know, like pretending something is a sword.
I think many boys can relate.
Yeah. Just, and my mother would say, I always knew where you were. Because if they asked me, hey, where is he? He's out there hitting the tree.
Yeah. So what was your first martial arts?
Was boxing.
Yeah, boxing. Yeah,
it was basic, just, you know, keep the hands up and, you know, move the head. I mean, that's really, my grandfather didn't do much more than that, aside from also how to throw straight punch.
Yeah.
But that was for initial experience. And then from there, my family, my mom really couldn't afford to put me in a lot of classes and things like that. But I would have friends who would do karate or taekwondo. Mm. And I would ask them to show me what they learned.
Yeah. So you did a bit of different stuff.
Yeah. Anything I could get my hands on.
But did you have any competitions in the different stuff you did?
Only in boxing initially.
Yeah.
Once I actually got to a gym when I was a little bit older. The rest was mostly like friendly sparring, you know, stuff like that.
Mm. But did you see yourself from the beginning more as an athlete or like a
competitor?
Yeah, like you want to do competition or did you want to be a trainer?
No, neither. Well, I don't want to say neither. The Icelandic coach that I'm very close to, Davi, he would say that I was a brain who always wanted to be a muscle.
Yeah.
So I was a very smart kid, but fat because I didn't know how to eat. I was athletic until I was about 9, and then I got heavy. I liked trying to do athletic things, but almost always failed.
Yeah.
So I didn't see myself as serious. So even when people would bully me, a lot of times I would just let it happen because I had no confidence.
Yeah.
Like none. I didn't decide to become serious about martial arts until I moved away from that city because of a hurricane, like the city was destroyed.
Yeah.
And moved to Virginia and I got a circle of friends who had the same interest.
Mm.
That's when I started to get really more thinking of myself as somebody who fought.
Mm.
But I was still very reserved about doing anything formal.
Yeah.
You see?
Yeah. But I know that one of your teachers were Mike McCallum.
Yes.
Was this many years later?
Yes.
Yeah.
That was when I came to Las Vegas.
Mm.
At some point in my mid-20s, I got out of a bad relationship. And during my early 20s when I went to film school, one of the teachers found out that I did martial arts and I was really into film.
Mm.
So I knew a lot about stunt people and what they had to do. So I actually ended up teaching a workshop class at my school about fighting in movies.
Yeah.
Right? But then that fell apart. I was in a relationship at the time. We broke up, very bad depression, you know, all that. And that's when I came to the decision, I have to do something with my body before I'm old.
Yeah.
And I made the decision to move to Las Vegas.
Yeah.
After a couple of months, I went to Top Rank Gym because I met a fighter named Kofi Jantua and we became friends. And he encouraged me to go to the gym. My first trainer there was actually Richie Sandoval. He was a bantamweight world champion. Yeah. But he liked me, but we didn't get along trainer, you know, like teacher-student wise.
Yeah.
But I noticed that every time I would spar, Mike would watch.
Okay.
So when I wanted to change coaches, Mike was the one that I felt like was noticing.
Yeah, it was natural for you.
Yeah.
Yeah. What did you learn from him?
Mike was kind of difficult to learn from because he doesn't really want to give you everything he knows.
Yeah.
I think you have to show Mike that you have aptitude. And I'm somebody who's smart but not very athletic. So he didn't see athletic aptitude with me. But I would talk to him and I would ask him millions of questions because I knew he trained with Emmanuel Stewart, George Benton, Eddie Futch, of course. And then his first trainer was Cuban, and I would ask him about his amateur days in Jamaica, you know, like, because he was 240-10 as an amateur.
Yeah, he had a lot of experience in international fights.
Yeah. And he kind of felt bad because the 1 year he went to the Olympics was the year the U.S. boycotted.
Yeah.
So he didn't get a chance to fight and in his mind beat very recognizable U.S. champion.
Yeah.
So, but I would ask him a lot of questions. Like, instead of just doing what he said, I would say, hey, Mike, what did Eddie say about this? Or what did Emmanuel say about this? Or what did Georgie say about this? Because that's what I really wanted.
Yeah.
You know, I wanted not just his... I didn't just want his opinion on how to box. I wanted everything he knew.
Yeah.
So I had to ask, you know. Yeah. Whereas when I became a coach later, I said to myself, the student shouldn't have to ask me that. Like, if you pay me, that's what I should give you. Everything that's in my head.
Mm. So he wasn't willing to give you everything.
Not
you
at first.
Yeah. But when you asked, did he open up?
Yes.
Yeah.
Because that's the thing that I learned about trainers like him and even Floyd Sr. The way I learned who taught Floyd Sr. his style is I just asked him. I said, where did you learn that? And he said, you know, nobody really asks me that.
Yeah.
And he said, it was a man named Dale Williams. And I asked him, why does nobody talk about Dale if he taught you? And he said, well, when I got with Dale, he was already over 70 years old.
Mm.
And I was like, oh, okay, now it starts. But he said, have you seen the fight with Leonard? Because that's the one everybody's seen.
Mm.
And I said, yeah. And he said, he's in my corner. And I was like, oh, like, I didn't even, you know, when you watch Floyd Sr. fight, you don't really pay attention to who's in the corner.
Yeah, that's the thing about boxing.
Yes, and it was the same with Mike. So, what I find is that when you ask these guys about who taught them, like where they learned this, sometimes they get really excited because that's what they don't get to teach. They don't get to talk about a lot, like their teachers and really important lessons that they learned from them.
Yeah, because I think that's interesting because when people ask me if I show them certain stuff, I can always say, well, I learned that from him at that place at that time. It's kind of fascinating because people usually just see the boxer and they don't think, well, where did he learn that? Or how did
and
he learn that?
This is also a sport of egos.
Mm.
So there's going to be people who want to behave as if they invented it.
Yeah, themselves.
Yes.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. But I met you at Johnny Tokos in 2016.
Yes.
I was coming here for a camp. And what was your first impression of me as a boxer?
Honestly, initially, similar to me.
Yeah.
I felt like this is a guy who's more of a brain, but wants to do this very physical activity. But that was actually kind of refreshing because it's not always easy to train athletically gifted people who that's what they've gone, they've survived by being athletically gifted.
Mm.
When you try to adjust the way they fight or the way they throw a punch or something like that, they tend to almost argue with you physically.
Because
they want to do it the way they want. You are more, you are way easier to communicate with.
Mm.
Which that's not a very common thing.
Yeah.
I honestly, I didn't know how good you could be.
Mm.
Because I did feel like seeing where you were at the time was not the whole story.
Yeah, well, I was, especially earlier in my career, I always thought that I had much more in me, which I hadn't shown yet.
Yeah.
So I felt when I came to you at Johnny Tacos, I learned some tools where I could use more of my repertoire, I could use more of my abilities.
Yes.
Because basically I was simply fighting on the outside, moving maybe too much at times, and not so comfortable on the inside. And usually always moving after a punch, but not so much before.
Yeah.
So that's some of the things I learned. But I can say that I want to talk a bit about your program and how you train, because for me, the biggest difference in from boxing training in Europe compared to the US is that in Europe, it's, you know, you have mostly amateur boxing, especially in Norway, and you have a club, you don't have a gym.
Right.
And the club, they have a class, maybe one class in the evening, and everybody does the same. But in the US, you have a gym which is open all day.
Yeah.
But you have a kind of different style than a typical gym, because when you come to a gym, you can just go on your own and not really have a trainer and do your own stuff. But you have a sort of a program where you learn people, the important fundamentals. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah. So when I first started coaching, I did very stereotypical. Student comes, they warm up, jump rope, shadow box, then mitts or shield or sparring, bags, some kind of exercise, done. When I was doing that with Mike, I would get frustrated. Like, is this it? You know, like, I feel like I'm doing the same workout. And I trained with three very, very high level former fighters. I trained with Richie, I trained with Mike, I trained with Mirky Sosa.
Yeah.
And really the biggest difference between them three was the way they did mitts, which were all different and good. You know, like the thing about doing a lot of mitt work is you feel like you're accomplishing a lot.
I know,
yeah.
And the trainer feels like they're really training someone.
Yeah, like they're
more involved.
The most important person there, yeah.
Yeah.
So, but I noticed that there was a big difference between how Eastern European fighters, just the way they move, and Cubans. And when Dadi came over from Iceland, he showed me things that where I was like, these are the missing steps from what I was doing, you know? And, you know, he would say that he learned some things from me as well, but really I'm like, because he changed completely the way I did things by saying, listen, if you take this format and then customize it to the way what you want to see, you'll get better results faster. And then, you know, with that inspiration in place, I started researching, like, well, how do they structure their program? Like, if you're in Cuba and you decide you want to box, how do they start you? And what do they do? Same thing about Russia or Ukraine, the former Soviet system.
Yeah.
And I realized that, first, one of the things that happened in the US is that a lot of really, really great trainers died. within the same 20 to 30 years. And they died without having an apprentice, you know, like somebody who does their program exactly the way they did it. Like as an example, Customato.
Yeah.
Customato, okay. Who can teach peekaboo? Teddy Atlas, Kevin Rooney, and there's a few others whose names I don't even know, but there's one guy in LA, Karan McMullen, who's a friend of mine. They can teach that exact system the same way Cus taught it.
Yeah.
You see? When they're gone, you may never find it again.
This is true.
So that happened in the US. Like a lot of great trainers, Whitey Enso, who trained Tony Canzanieri.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. He didn't have Canzanieri. He had Willie Pastrano. And Willie Pastrano was a guy that Muhammad Ali saw and said, I want to move like that. He also trained Ralph Dupas because Enzo was an amateur coach who never wanted to be a professional coach.
Yeah.
So he would send his guys to Angelo Dundee.
Mm.
You know, there were guys like that all throughout the United States. Mm. It's like if you look at a fighter like Charlie Burley, yeah, he was a legendary fighter, but
where did he learn
who it? Taught him how to fight?
Yeah.
Yes. And it's really hard to find this information.
Mm.
So I started doing as much digging as I humanly could to find out where different parts of the world originated their teaching.
Mm.
And what I decided was that I wanted to kind of blend as much of it as I could.
Mm.
So I have a very rigid program in terms of how I teach the fundamentals. But what ends up happening is once they learn the fundamentals, the way I do it, when they start sparring, they know what they're doing, you know? And that's my main practice. And it's like, anybody who knows me knows that I don't downgrade other trainers as a habit. Like, my philosophy is anybody who can take a kid who knows nothing and teach them something is doing a good job.
Mm.
But at the same time, we have to strive for more. Like, what do you want for yourself?
Yeah, and improve.
Right. And for me, the main thing I want is for anybody to look at anyone I've taught and say, man, everyone Luis trained knows how to fight.
Yeah.
Like, they don't have to be world champion, but every dude that guy trained, or every, even female fighters, like every fighter he's ever trained really looks like they know what they're doing.
Mm.
That's enough for me.
Because that's one thing I can say about your fighters is that even though if many of them don't have that much experience, and even if they're some are a different size than others, different age, different experience, of course, they all know how to box.
Right.
They have the fundamentals in
right.
place. And what are some really important things you need to learn before you step into the ring and have a fight?
Well, this is just my personal perspective. I mean, a great coach from Philadelphia, Billy Briscoe, like he and I have like friendly conversations like this about what we think is best. And I remember Billy told me, he said a lot of the old school trainers in Philly, in a setting like this, the gym is done for the day, everybody's gone. He said all the coaches would sit around and exchange knowledge. Or like, let's say you're my fighter. I would ask another coach, hey, what do you think how Alex is doing?
Mm.
Well, I think he needs to work on this. And you know, you guys are doing really good with this and maybe try this.
Yeah.
Well, in all the years I've been in gyms in Vegas and a few in other states, I don't see that much.
No.
You know? So, and you're saying same thing in Norway, like you don't see that thing very often, but it should be, because the coaches, it's us who needs to make each other better.
Yeah, I think it's easy for people to think that it's just a boxer who needs to improve, but the trainer has to improve.
They can't improve themselves, yeah, where they go watch YouTube videos, which, you know, it's common practice nowadays. But, so, my number one thing for sparring, and like I'm going through this with my son. Like my son is 9 years old and wants to start sparring. when my wife asks me, why doesn't he spar? He's been in the gym since he's 1 year old. And I tell her, I don't know how he's going to respond to getting hit very hard. Mm. So I have to ease him into it. And because sometimes he doesn't always listen, when I need him to defend himself,
yeah,
defending punches, moving the head, you know, catching or blocking, if I tell him to do it, is he going to do it? Or is he going to behave as if he doesn't have to and then take the damage? If I tell him he needs to box with the chin down, is he going to throw this?
Yeah.
So really what I need to see is defensive responsibility. Basically, you're not going to take punches just to take punches. From there, defensive responsibility means using the moves that I've given you, like using the tools. You know, like, what if you have a mechanic, he's trying to fix a car, and he needs to use the ratchet, but refuses to use the ratchet.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I don't think I need to use that. Now we have a problem.
Yeah.
Because that's the tool to do this.
Mm.
So you don't want to use it, what are you going to do? Hit it with a hammer? You know what I mean? Like, it's not going to work. So responsibility to use the tools and to protect themselves.
Yeah.
Right after that is balance. I think balance is one of the most underrated things in a beginning student. Like, and when I say balance, what I mean is the ability to hold position.
Yeah.
Because I tell them, your position protects you.
Mm.
You know, if my legs go straight and I pop up and...
Yeah, or if you throw a jab and you fall in with your head all the time, you're in trouble.
Everything hurts more when you're out of position. So, defensive responsibility, balance, and some kind of good decision making. Like you don't aggressively make mistakes.
Yeah. So those are two very important things, because I think when you start sparring or when you start getting punched in the face, you learn a lot about the person.
Right.
Because there's a difference between just doing it in the gym and actually doing it while you're getting punched.
Well, and those three are requirements for sparring, not for fighting.
Fight is completely different again.
Yeah.
Because then there's more on the line.
Yes. And even my experienced fighters will tell you that in the gym you might be able to use 50 tools competently. Like, people watch you and go, oh my god, that guy's amazing. He can go this way, he can go this way, he step back, and land counter punches. Then comes the fight, and you can use three consistently. Because those are the three that you've always been able to depend on to survive.
Mm.
See, so we try to, my philosophy is to try to equip the students not merely to survive, but to progress.
Yeah.
So if I know that you can only use two or three moves in sparring, you're not qualified to fight yet. You know?
Yeah.
And I also, as you know, I do a lot of, I'm very big on mental conditioning.
Mm.
You know, like, one thing that I do that I think some coaches don't understand is, if you're a first-time fighter, before you fight, I'm going to tell you, Alex, after the first round of your first fight, you're going to be convinced you cannot go anymore.
Yeah.
You're going to come to the corner and you're going to tell me, Lou, I'm done. I'm done, man. I'm finished. I can't feel my legs. I can't catch my breath. Very, very rarely have I seen different. Like, very rarely have I seen a fighter eager to go to the second round after the first round of first fight.
Yeah.
And the reason why I tell them that, because my colleagues and my peers might say, is he trying to talk the guy out of fighting? Like, that, why would you tell him that?
Yeah.
And it's like, no. I don't want to talk them out of fighting. I want them to be prepared.
Yeah. Yeah, because I think many trainers don't talk about the nerves you feel like during a fight or before a fight.
Yeah.
It's like, you just have to be tough. But when you get there, it's really hard and you don't know how to handle all the different emotions.
Just the tension can fatigue you after one round.
Yeah, that's, it's more, the mental stuff is more fatiguing than the physical stuff.
Right. So that's why I tell, and then if they ask me, because I look for how they respond to hearing this.
Yeah.
And if they stay there and go, okay, what do I do? And I go, you just have to remember that you are conditioned.
Yeah.
You do 100 burpees. You've done 8 rounds of sparring. Your body can do it.
Yeah.
The thing that's stopping it is your mind.
Yeah.
Like you're convincing yourself. So you gotta just get back out there and do that second round.
Mm.
But you have to know somewhere deep in the back of your mind that I'm prepared for this.
Yeah.
Because if you lose sight of that, you're gonna give up.
So you almost have to override your head. So even though you feel like quitting, you have to tell yourself, well, I know I can do it anyway.
Yes.
Because I've done it every day in training.
Yes. Yeah. That's the only way. Well, I don't wanna say the only way. Because you can fake your way past it.
Mm.
But the problem is if you fake your way past it, then the day that comes that shatters, because you know some people say fake it until you make it, which in some levels is useful.
Yeah, but one day you're gonna meet someone.
Right, and when that is gone, you don't get it back.
Mm.
You don't get it back. So I would rather take the approach of being honest. You know, being, I want my fighters to be honest with themselves.
Yeah.
And even if they really can't go anymore, you know, I learned a very important lesson from an Irish coach.
Yeah.
We had an event here, Ireland against Las Vegas. And the problem was the Irish fighters thought that they were going to fight 4 days after they landed.
Okay, yeah.
But they moved the event up. So they landed on Thursday and the fight was on Friday.
Oh, yeah.
Now, what is the thing about coming from Ireland to here and trying to fight?
Jet lag.
A lot of jet lag.
Yeah.
So when his fighters began the first round, they looked nice.
Mm.
But then you could see very quick decline.
Yeah.
And I remember this man standing on the corner, like 5 fights in a row.
Yeah.
He's throwing the towel. And people are in the audience are like, oh. They're getting mad because they want to see boxing. And it's an amateur show, but. And later on, when I spoke to him, I don't remember his name. I don't even remember the club's name. This was years ago. But he said, they're jet lagged. Why would I let them get beat up?
Yeah.
He's like, I don't care if they get a loss
on record. Yeah.
Although I think it was they were on no contest because there's something in the amateur rules about when you throw the towel.
Okay.
So he said, I don't care. He said, there's no need for them to go through the further humiliation and physical damage.
Yeah.
The moment I saw that they cannot handle.
Yeah.
And that taught me a lot about the coach's responsibility.
Mm.
Because if we had the just...
Yeah, just because the coach can have a big ego as well.
Yes.
And don't want to let the fighter lose.
Yeah.
They'd rather let them get beat up.
Right. And see, I don't want to say I don't have an ego at all, because I probably do. But I'm aware that my time is over.
Mm.
You know, like, I had negligible amount of amateur fights. One pro fight that I lost, I'm done. It's not my time.
Yeah.
It's their time. But if it's their time, then I have to be responsible. You know? Like, I cannot behave like their time is my time.
Yeah, I understand.
Yeah.
So, but in your program, you do a lot more than just train fighters. Because, you talk to them as well about... personal issues, because I think the boxing gym attracts a lot of different people, but especially people with some problems. But how is that important to prepare a fighter?
Well, I always told my fighters from the beginning that when you go in here, you're not a different person.
Mm-hmm.
It's not magic. Who I am right here is who I am in there.
Yeah.
So whatever weaknesses or hang-ups I have right now out here. If I go in there, I take them with me.
Mm.
And the thing I realized about really intelligent coaches and trainers is they can spot them.
Yeah.
So if that coach can spot that weakness in you, then you can always be defeated the same way over and over again. Plus, that's the same truth with life. You know, like if you have a hang up you cannot get past, you will always fail at the same point over and over again in life. This is true of for myself. Like when I first started as a coach, I didn't do this as much. I did because I wanted to get to know my fighters, but I didn't do it at the level that I do now. And I'm not a therapist, but there's an old saying that boxing coaches used to have to be doctor, father, therapist, you know, like everything wrapped into one person. But the truth of the matter is, if they need a doctor, I need to find them a doctor, you know? Or if they need a therapist, I need to find them a therapist. Mm. But what I realized over time is, you guys, you could die in there. You know, like
you have a huge responsibility.
Yeah, it's combat.
Yeah.
So if I see something mentally blocking you from doing your best, I have to bring it up.
Mm.
If I don't, I'm not doing my job. I've lost fighters over that. You know, I've lost fighters over that who did not want to confront certain things.
Yeah.
When I needed them to confront it, or when I should say when they needed to confront it, and that's okay, you know, that's okay. Like they can make a different decision and try something else. That's fine. But at the time, my perspective was, listen, you have this problem, and if you don't deal with it, you're always gonna lose this same way over and over and over again. You know, so I started doing, you know, that's part of the mental training aspect, is that I'm going to try to address any weakness I see.
Yeah, you know? Because it's gonna be exposed.
Yes.
Sometime or other in the ring.
Right, and for myself, I don't want to answer for that later in life. You know, for people to say, hey, you knew this guy had this problem, why you didn't do anything? Like. When I confront these things with my students, I sleep at night.
Yeah.
You know, knowing that I at least tried and did to do my part, you know, to help them get past them.
Yeah. Because I can imagine that boxers, they're not always so easy to talk to.
No.
And not so easy to work with either. So it's really a tough
There's usually three types. A lot of fighters are really emotional, hard on the sleeve kind of person. Like, they want to find somebody that they can tell everything.
Yeah.
Or the exact opposite. They're not going to tell you anything at all.
Mm-hmm.
Or they're going to lie.
Yeah.
They're going to tell you everything is always fine.
Mm-hmm.
And the last one are really difficult because those are the ones that they won't tell you when they're hurt.
Yeah.
You have to be really observant. They won't tell you if they have a headache.
Yeah.
You know, they won't tell you if they were sick. They won't, they keep those things because...
Do they see it as a weakness?
Yes.
Oh.
Yeah, usually. Or even if they're smarter, they see admitting it as a weakness.
Yeah.
They might know something's very wrong. But if they admit it, you know, in here, then they think I'm being weak, and it's you're not. Like, if you have a headache, you shouldn't spar that day. You know, it's that simple.
Yeah.
You know, but sometimes they feel like they're letting down the trainer, and it's no, you're not letting me that.
Yeah.
I don't care. Like I try. Like,
yeah, you don't take it personal,
right?
If he has a bad day or it can't show up,
right?
Yeah.
I used to.
It's very hard to distinct. Keep them.
I
not take it personal.
I had to mature as a trainer to not be that guy because I used to be that guy. You know, because I made the mistake of expecting everyone to be me. Because I was a gym rat. You know, like I was a gym rat. Like I never didn't show up. Even on days when my coach didn't show up, I would call him and ask him what he wanted me to do. I was that guy. So, but I started to realize that expecting them to replicate that without even understanding my motivations of like why I did that was wrong. Like I can't expect that from them. You know?
Yeah, I understand. And I think also for some fighters, they think that it's a weakness to tell them that they're tired or they can't do it today, and it's a really complex situation.
Yeah.
Because I know that when you have a camp before a fight, not every sparring can be perfect. You always have some bad days.
Yeah.
You will always, maybe you do some mistakes, you will get hit sometimes, but then you just have to, I think it's more of a strength if you can tell yourself that, well, I just had a bad day, it will be better tomorrow. And then just move on and do the proper adjustments instead of being like, oh, well, oh, I'm so awful and I can't do this anymore.
I would be more concerned if the fighter was perfect every day. I would be very like, what am I really seeing? But that, to me, that's how trainers need to be. Like, we need to be always observing for what is wrong. You know, like, even if everything seems right, we have to be the one going, wait a minute, this cannot be perfect. You know, like, something's wrong here. And then you find out that the guy's mother died, or you didn't even know, or something happened like that. And really what you're seeing is that they're bringing, they're putting their grief into their training. And it, that was Buster Douglas with Mike Tyson.
Yeah, of course.
You know, Buster, on the night that Buster Douglas fought Mike Tyson, he was almost textbook perfect heavyweight. But what made him that? You see? So it could have been very easy for the trainers in that case, because I don't know how that went down behind the scenes, but it could have been very easy for those trainers to get arrogant after that and say, no, 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 he's fine now. But they didn't fully understand. I mean, I think they did in real life, but I'm saying they may not have understood that the perfection they were seeing, that they were getting from him, was coming from sorrow. And that once the sorrow passes,
They want to experience that kind of
again,
sorrow.
Right.
So we're at Real Boxing in Las Vegas now. How can people want to join a program or train you with you?
Well, I can be reached by phone. My phone number is 702-274-5968. You know, can text or call that, or come down to the gym, Real Boxing, 6145 West Sahara Avenue in Las Vegas. It's pretty much that easy, and we'll go from there.
Well, thanks for the chat.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you.
Appreciate it. Thank you.